Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brock and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!
Well, good afternoon to everyone with us today. My name is Alan Phillips, attorney at law, practice surrounding the vaccine rights issue, vaccine exemptions and waivers. Regret to inform everyone that the Homeopathy World Community founder, Debbie Brock, and inspiration initially for this show, is not able to be with us today as usual, but we will welcome Debbie back hopefully next week or soon. But I'm very pleased to say that we have with us, filling in for Debbie today, the Pandemic Response Project Manager, Mr. Rich Roberts. Rich, how are you doing today?
Doing well. Thank you, Alan. Thanks for having me on.
Well, it's our pleasure to have you with us today, Rich. Rich has been a tremendous resource and support person and help to me with the Pandemic Response Project. I don't know if we've talked about that extensively recently here on the show, but just in very quick summary, the Pandemic Response Project, as the name implies, is something that was a response to vaccine concerns that emerged during the recent so-called swine flu pandemic of 2009 and 10. And during that time, I learned that vaccine, or let's say this, emergency health laws in states around the country, probably most states, enable the states, if they declare an emergency, an infectious disease emergency, to mandate emergency vaccines without exemptions, without, in many cases, the usual religious or religious and philosophical exemptions, and in some cases even medical exemptions, that are routinely available, one or more of them, in every state with regard to routine immunizations and infectious diseases. So when a declared emergency exists, rights can change radically. And so people can still refuse vaccines even if there is no exemption, but the consequences for doing that in an emergency are that you are potentially subject to being quarantined in a government facility, possibly against your will. And so the Pandemic Response Project seeks to reform emergency health laws that would prevent people from having a sufficient and adequate amount of freedom of choice concerning vaccines in a declared emergency. And again, Rich has been most helpful with that. So, Rich, thank you for your help and support with that project.
Oh, well, thank you, Alan, for being the force behind this in the first place.
Well, my great pleasure. I'm driven in ways that I don't even fully recognize or understand consciously, but I feel like I'm in the right place doing the right thing. So today we're going to talk, as we often do, about a few vaccine news items, current news items, but we're also going to be doing some vaccine legislative updates. There is a lot going on legislatively around the country on the vaccine issue, and we're not going to hit it all by any means, but we're going to hit a few key points, and in particular projects legislative issues that I've been involved with around the country. And so we want to bring people up to date on that and let people know who are in the affected states what they can do to help. Or if you know someone in an affected state, that you could pass along some information to help them get on board. Because there is, as listeners of this show probably know, a very aggressive pro-vaccine faction that is operating on multiple levels, and one of those levels is to push through legislation that in most recent times, and this is happening in states around the country, that for our purposes as it pertains to vaccines and vaccine rights, is restricting or limiting access to vaccine exemptions, making it more difficult for people to exercise exemptions, and making it easier for vaccines to be administered. In particular, there are states that have laws allowing children to consent to vaccines. So we'll get to that a little bit later in the show. But Rich, let's move to a few current events here in the news arena with vaccines. And by the way, I'll let folks know that when we talk about vaccine news items on the air here with Homeopathy World Community Radio on the Thursday Vaccines and Your Rights show, we are most often discussing articles that are linked from the Pandemic Response Project's news page. So the URL for those who want to follow up on these or to look at other articles that we just won't have time to get to, because there's always more going on than we have time to get to on the show, it's Pandemic Response Project, those three words all spelled out, no hyphens or underscores or anything between them, just all run together, pandemicresponseproject.com. So we hope that you'll take some time later after the show and from time to time to take a look at that page, because there's almost daily new articles being added and a lot going on in this arena all the time. I'm never worried about having enough to talk about on the show. Quite the opposite. We never have time to get to all the things we'd like to talk about. Rich, where would you like to start with us? I know we had talked last night about some of the things we wanted to discuss today. Is there a particular place you'd like to start, Rich, on some of the current news?
Well, why don't we start with the Vaccine Research Library? And this is a new concept by our colleague, Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who's a physician and a vaccine expert and a health freedom advocate. But basically what she is doing is assembling a database to collect this ever-growing body of scientific and medical information that actually supports our side of the vaccine debate. It's quite easy to find information that is pro-vaccine, and the mainstream media is full of that kind of information. But the hardcore information that backs up, you know, vaccine rights and debunks the conventional pro-vaccine kind of science is going to be at this new site. And so I think this is pretty exciting news. This could potentially be a very useful resource for a lot of different people.
And I'll just mention, rather than trying to give sites over the air, that if folks go to the PandemicResponseProject.com news page, they'll find a link right near the top right now, because this is a very recent announcement and a very recent link then to the Vaccine Research Library. But this is just incredible news. There are some wonderful things happening on our side of the issue here, despite the aggressive movement to the contrary. Sherry Tenpenny, originally, when she first came on to the vaccine issue, wasn't even aware, for example, of the ingredients in vaccines. And I remember reading about her discussing this, that she just thought there was the vaccine ingredient and maybe a little saline or something else in there. And this is probably the truth with most doctors, that they have no idea the long list of toxic and carcinogenic ingredients that are in vaccines. Now, the theory, the pro-vaccine theory, is that they're in very small quantities and so they don't cause any harm, but there's lots of research to dispute that. But I have to say that Sherry has gone from her early days of knowing nothing about the issue to becoming one of the most educated medical doctors, I think, on the planet about this issue. She is exceptionally intelligent, exceptionally motivated, an exceptionally good researcher and writer. And for her to be, she's the ideal person or one of the ideal people I could think of to head up this kind of a project. So I'm delighted that she took this on and has this. But, you know, Rich, there's a very interesting issue underlying the whole notion of medical studies in a more general sense, because people have been stepping out right outside of the mainstream medical community more and more in recent times, complaining or pointing to the difficulty with which of our being able to even rely on the medical literature at all as a general proposition. In particular, there's a Dr. Marcia Angel with Harvard University who, back in 2008, went public. And she, by the way, was an editor with the New England Journal of Medicine for 20 years. You don't get much more mainstream and having direct finger on the pulse, as it were, of the medical literature than somebody in that kind of position and with those kind of credentials. And she said, as long ago now, this would have been 3 or 4 years ago, that we could no longer trust the medical literature. And I believe she's written a book about the issue, but the basic concept, as I understood it, had to do with the fact that what gets published is based really much more on what's going to be profitable than anything else. And so there's apparently tremendous pressure within the medical publishing community. People can advance their careers by getting published, or drugs can be sold if studies are favorable and get published. And what we've ended up with, according to some experts, is a body of medical literature that collectively as a body is no longer even really reliable, that you have to look past a study's conclusions and go back and reassess the data and what actually happened before you can know whether or not, and of course would have to have the skills and knowledge to do that, before you really know what you can rely on and what you can't rely on. But in any event, we do have a very selective process going on from health authorities when they say, here are the studies that prove or disprove vaccines cause autism, you know, that kind of thing. There are studies that support, at least in their conclusions, the vaccine, pro-vaccine stance and agenda, but oftentimes when those studies are scrutinized, they're found not really to hold up.
Well, that's right, Alan. There are so many conflicts of interest, and people need to realize that some of these so-called official studies are really dealing with economic forces more than scientific, kind of undisputable scientific fact. And that's why this research library, I think, is right on time, because this issue is opening up more and more. People are asking, you know, more and more questions about vaccine safety, and about, you know, they have more and more concerns about some of the ingredients in vaccines, the chemicals, the heavy metals, the foreign DNA, et cetera. And so I think this is really going to be helpful to people because, as you well know, a person can spend, you know, hours of time sifting through information, looking for those true gems on the web. And so this site is going to do a lot of that preliminary research for people. There's going to be, you know, a lot of kind of prearranged categories. There's going to be, you know, information indexed already by subject so people can find exactly what they're looking for. And it also looks like there's a pretty serious attempt to make this not just a scientific but also kind of deal with underlying legal issues. So hopefully that will also be a valuable resource for attorneys such as yourself.
Well, I'm seeing, you know, as you know, Rich, from your own extensive research on the subject, there are many, many websites with terrific information. But what we're seeing in some different ways in recent times in this issue are some websites that are taking a more focused approach in terms of providing unanimity of position or tools. And three websites come to mind when I say this. And the first one, and I'm not sure if I'm got the label exactly correct. So, Rich, if you know otherwise, please tell me. But something like the world, somebody has taken on the project of putting, getting medical doctors and other healthcare professionals to align behind this issue on a single website. And I don't remember now if it's called the World Council on Vaccination or something like that, and I apologize to listeners. We'll see if we can find that before the end of the show and give you the accurate label. But the point is this, that if we can get a significant number of medical doctors and other health authorities to all sign on to a single general statement or position, and that's what the website is attempting to do and is doing and has done and is hopefully increasing that by adding more physicians to that list all the time. That's a powerful statement, that one website in and of itself. Now, Sherry Tenpenny has just come up with just an incredible tool here, a focus tool by pulling together research that shows problems with vaccines into a single place. And so anyone, medical doctor, non-medical doctor, layperson, parent, attorney, this is information, of course, from my point of view, that could have lots of potential uses in perhaps in vaccine injury cases or other kinds of vaccine disputes where people need to be able to pull up information easily and quickly to show that the mainstream views just don't hold up to scrutiny. And I hear about cases where doctors get on the stand and say, oh, yes, this child has a 100% chance of catching these diseases if he's not vaccinated, which is just absolutely ludicrous. But if the attorney on the other side isn't prepared to say, well, would you please read, you know, the conclusion of this following study, or, you know, doesn't have the legal or medical research to put in front of them on cross-exam, then that will stand. And there was actually a case in Florida where the parents lost the exemption because a doctor got up in favor of the, in this case it was a dispute between parents, got up in front of the court as an expert witness and said exactly that. There's a 100% chance this child will get these diseases. So this is the kind of thing I think that can really help a lot of people. It'll be a terrific tool. The other tool, I'm going to toot my own horn here for just a second, on my own website, the vaccinerights.com website, I have a page that is a legislative projects page, and I have been working with activists in states around the country for a couple of years or more at this point, fairly actively and particularly recently, developing letters or legal memorandums or legal arguments. And it's just a real brief explanation, Rich. If you have a bill or law that's already in place in your state that you are for or against, and you contact a state legislator, your own local representative, and you say, I'm for or against this bill or this law, you are initially approaching them as a one-person, one-vote status. But if you go to this person and you say, here's a compelling legal argument as to why this bill is unconstitutional, let's say, and therefore, legally, really, we can't pass this bill, you're raising the stakes for the state legislator. Now, the practical reality is they can pass anything they get the votes for, whether it's legal or not, constitutional or not, and then if somebody wants to challenge it in court, they're free to do that. But the political fallout of supporting an unconstitutional bill or law would give rise even to someone whose concerns have nothing to do with truth in law and are all political based. And unfortunately, this happens a lot in the state and national legislative arena, that things are not, you know, we always have this veneer of what's best for the public put on top of whatever's going on, but often if you look beneath the veneer, what you see going on has little or nothing to do with public well-being, has to do with some other corporate or other interest or agenda. So these legal arguments can add weight to activists' positions. And so it's terrific to see that there are people like Sherry Tenpenny and others who are putting together more focused and powerful tools. I think this really is going to help to move the vaccine controversy forward to a place of shedding some light on these issues. So, having said that, let's go ahead and move on because we've got lots of things to talk about.
Well, let's do. I wanted to bring up briefly a recent paper, and this is it's entitled Virtual Mentor, and this is by Suzanne Sheely and Joel Meyer. And they're lamenting the fact that they're unable to get adequate recruits to volunteer for experimental vaccine testing. And they're saying that just relying on people's goodwill and generosity is not enough anymore. It's unsustainable. And so their solution to this problem is compulsory involvement in vaccine studies. At least that's a solution. So
wait a minute. Say that one more time, Rich, because this is really this is a really important point on so many levels here. I think the first part of what, and bears repeating, the first part of what you said is it sounds like they're having trouble getting volunteers for vaccine research when they get to the stage where they have to start now testing new vaccines on human beings. And I'll just say real briefly, gee, I wonder why that might be the case.
That's right. You would think everybody would want to be a human guinea pig, wouldn't you, Alan?
Well, for vaccines, they've saved millions, and gosh, another vaccine. And for me to be able to say I helped that along, you know, now we can cure cocaine with the vaccine. And you think, you may laugh when I say that, but there are over 330 vaccines currently under development or already on the market for anything and everything, including cocaine addiction. So I was not being facetious. Well, maybe I was, but I was also being serious with that comment. But let's move on to that next part again one more time for our listeners, because, Rich, this is a really important point.
Well, you know, basically this paper is bemoaning the fact that they cannot find adequate volunteers to participate in these vaccine studies. And these are completely experimental studies, and they make some lame points in this paper, you know, to the effect that the volunteers are fully informed of possible complications, as if that would be anything that would convince anybody to do this. On the contrary, several studies have shown that serious complications are withheld from the volunteers and that they do not know. But this is pretty much like, you know, the draft. It's a mandatory involvement in these trials. It's not giving the people any sort of choice about their involvement, or at least this proposal. Or it wouldn't give the people any choice in the maybe the inherent risk that they would be exposed to. All this, of course, been justified, Alan, for the greater good of society. So it is somewhat scary, because more and more it just seems like all of our individual rights are completely ignored under the banner of the greater good. And it's just not a good trend.
It's really interesting to me, Rich, and I mean, it's disturbing as it is interesting, I suppose, as well. But the pro-vaccine agenda just marches on under this banner of vaccines are the end-all and be-all to getting rid of infectious disease, and they're perfectly safe and effective. And it's just fascinating to me, because they have controlled the mainstream media and people's beliefs so well for so long. There's this bold arrogance that they can just keep on doing that. And, of course, they've gotten mileage out of that over the years. They've managed to suppress alternative views for decades. And by the way, you know, vaccines have been around for, what, something on the order, give or take, of 150 years at this point. There have always, historically, there has always been an anti-vaccine faction or movement. But it has, for the most part, always been kept to one degree or another under control. The whole history is an interesting and separate topic here. But what is so interesting to me is the idea that while over the short term, taking the all-or-nothing approach, if you will, from the pro-vaccine side seems to get them some ground, because they still have a stranglehold over much of the public using fear as a very effective control mechanism. And yet, they ultimately... the risk in doing that is that as people become more aware, they lose all credibility. A
right.
Much more effective strategy might be for them to engage, even if reluctantly and minimally and in a controlled sort of way, as we would expect if it happened at all, in a conversation, so that as people inevitably learn about the problems, they're not just going to suddenly lose complete and total credibility. I mean, I think what we're looking at is the total downfall of the medical system as we now understand it, because vaccines, of course, are only one part of that, but it's a major cornerstone, and the take-no-prisoners, all-or-nothing position just doesn't hold up to scrutiny. And despite the control of the media and the propaganda for decades and decades and increasing conditions, those kinds of conditions being the same or being enhanced and propaganda more effective and so forth. What we see is evidence that a growing number of people, growing percentage of the population, does more so and more so have concerns about vaccines. So there is movement on both sides of this issue. But I think inevitably that all or nothing position of the pro-vaccine folks is going to lead to their demise.
Right. And there's a great quote here by Ronald Reagan, actually, Alan, that I would like to share that ties into this real nicely. And this is from 1961, and Ronald Reagan said that one of the traditional methods of imposing socialism on a people has been by way of medicine. It is very easy to disguise a medical program as a humanitarian project. So I think that perfectly ties into the debate over vaccine effectiveness and safety. It's always the same kind of thing. It's actually reminiscent of the horrifying eugenics programs, Alan, that they were trying to implement at the beginning of the 20th century. And they always, you know, whenever our liberties are trampled on like this, they always justify that as a matter of public health, or that's a very convenient way to go about doing it. It's like they hide behind a banner of safety. But nothing could be more unsafe, in my mind, than being a guinea pig for these trials.
Well, and it's interesting, too, because, boy, all kinds of things come to mind as you're talking about that, Rich. I mean, Bill Gates is heavily invested billions of dollars into getting vaccines around the world under the, I think I would have to use the word pretense, just from my own personal opinion or perspective, of saving millions and millions of lives around the world and so forth. But boy, what a classic example, at least potentially. Now, I want to clarify a point here, because let's say, for the sake of discussion, that there's a particular campaign asserted or moved forward or attempted to move forward under the pretense of being public health, but maybe it's really something else. I bet there were lots of people, for example, who bought into the idea that the eugenics program was really a good thing for the benefit of public health. And there certainly are people who buy into the idea that anything we can do to promote vaccines is for the public good. So, in fact, I tend to believe, and if it's naivete on my part, then I'll claim my naivete proudly in this moment. But I think the vast majority of medical doctors, the vast majority of people who work for the pharmaceutical industry, for example, are people of integrity, people who know and do well, mean well. Many of them are misinformed. It's interesting because I've had pharmaceutical employees as clients, and I'm always real careful because I don't want to say anything that will offend them, but inevitably I'll get, rather than some sort of indication that I better not say anything bad about the pharmaceutical industry, quite the contrary, I almost always get some sort of comment about, yeah, I see this firsthand, it's really crazy. So I think people in the pharmaceutical industry maybe know more about what's going on, even though most of those individuals are not happy with some of the problems that go on in the industry, but they certainly see it.
Right, and I would agree with that too, Alan, and I think that's sort of the hope going forward, is that most of these people, you know, really are good people and want to do well, even if they're misled by a small group of bad scientist types.
Yeah. Well, let me jump in here with, we're trying to move us forward because we've got so much to get to today. I want to make just a real short announcement about something I discovered just this morning, and this came from an organization that's called, or their website is demandprogress.org, and apparently there is a bill now at the national level that Senator McCain is sponsoring, and then the ACLU, it's a new cybersecurity bill, and the ACLU's position on this is that this is a privacy nightmare that will eventually result in the military substantially monitoring the domestic civilian internet. So I see things all the time about threats to the internet, and, you know, he who controls the internet controls much about what people know or think or believe, as has been traditionally what occurs with those who control mainstream media. But people are increasingly going to the internet for their news and information and everything else, shopping and so forth. So control over the internet is increasingly an important issue. So I just want to alert people to that. There's information at demandprogress.org. Become informed about this bill, and if the ACLU's take on it is correct, and it's definitely something that anybody who wants to have the internet be a free and fair and open place to share information and not have the military monitoring that, might want to get involved and take some action with this.
That's right. The internet is the last bastion of free speech, and we need to keep it that way.
Absolutely. Well, there's another piece of information about Professor John Walker Smith. You want to talk about that briefly?
Yes, this is the co-author with Andrew Wakefield, and he had been involved in an ongoing court battle to clear his name of wrongdoing, and he won that case.
He had been accused of either unethical practice or malpractice or something, and lost his license, as Andrew Wakefield did. Is that correct? That is correct.
And so he has been vindicated, and hopefully now Andrew Wakefield will get the same treatment, and that could be a really huge victory for us, Alan.
Well, it's certainly by implication, as a co-author who, along with Andrew Wakefield, lost his license, and now he's gone up on appeal in the courts in England or United Kingdom, and has succeeded. And this is just absolutely wonderful news, of course, for him as an individual. He's a man of retirement age, or may have already been retired, but to have to carry that weight when you know you've done nothing wrong and yet you've been ganged up on and had your license taken away, what a horrible way to go into retirement. And now he's been exonerated, and that is just wonderful news, but not just for him personally, for the entire vaccine movement, because what it reveals is that there was, in fact, as many of us have been saying all along, a witch hunt.
Right.
And my understanding now is that Wakefield did not appeal his decision, and I read something just this morning that said that Professor John Walker Smith's insurance covered his appeal, and that was not the case with Andrew Wakefield. I don't know if that's the reason why Wakefield didn't appeal his ruling. But Andrew Wakefield's been living in the U.S. for a while. He's in Texas now, and he has an active court case where he is suing the journalist, I believe his name was John Deere, and the British Medical Journal, and the editor of the British Medical Journal, because they keep, even though this issue started years ago, at this point, the original article, I think, was published in 1997 or 98, that this has all been about. And these folks just keep slandering him. So he's got a defamation lawsuit, libeling or slandering him or both. And so he's got a defamation lawsuit in Texas, and we'll certainly keep you posted on as we hear information about that in future shows here. But
right.
this just bodes really well. I mean, it was only Professor John Walker Smith who was exonerated. Andrew Wakefield has officially not been exonerated, but it certainly carries strong implications and for both of them.
That's right. This could renew our faith in the judicial system, Alan, if Andrew Wakefield were exonerated.
Well, it certainly would. I mean, it was the General Medical Council in the UK, which is the organization that controls medical doctor licensing in the UK, that took away both of these doctors' licenses, and Professor Walker Smith now has his back. So we'll see what happens. Man, Wakefield's lawsuit, I don't think, is going to result in getting his license back, but it certainly could, if successful, go a long way to exonerate him as well. Well, we got any other important news items we want to get to, because we want to talk about some legislative updates as well this afternoon.
Well, let me cover one more news item, and this is a great segue into the work that you're currently doing in the state of North Carolina and in other states, Alan, but this from Detroit, Michigan, where a mother is furious. Her name is Sigil Kinney, but her 14-year-old daughter was given 4 shots at school by the school nurse. This is at Marcus Garvey Academy, and this was without the mother's permission. And the mother's gone further to say that she even had a document on file that, you know, nobody was to administer medical treatment to her daughter. She was particularly upset that one of the shots was the HPV, which, as you know, has been very problematic and created a lot of adverse events. And so the mother is outraged. She wants somebody to be held accountable for this. The spokesman for the public school system basically passed the buck because in this instance, the school has some connection with St. John's, and so St. John's Medical actually had administered these shots, apparently. And St. John's, you know, this is the typical type of statements that we get, Alan. They come out and say that they're aware of a situation involving a student treated, and that they'll meet with the student's family to ensure that the issue is addressed appropriately. It's just so much non-speak, and it doesn't give me a warm, fuzzy feeling that, you know, they will address the situation appropriately. But it's a great lead-in to, you know, what you're doing in North Carolina, and as you know, recently in California, they passed a law that 12-year-olds could get the HPV vaccine without parental consent. So I think this is where we're headed. A lot of parents are going to be more and more outraged that the school system just takes the authority with their children and pressures them into vaccines and other unnecessary medical types of treatment.
It's interesting. I mean, I can't say I'm surprised at that sort of thing happened, and I suspect it probably happens from time to time, and I'll bet most parents would, parents who don't have concerns about vaccines would probably shrug it off and wouldn't even be an issue, or maybe even say, oh, thanks, now I don't have to take my kid out and get those vaccines for myself. But obviously for people who have concerns about vaccines, it's a horror story. And it's a simple enough thing to overlook something in a file. I mean, is a nurse who's vaccinating kids going to pull open a file every time and look to see if there's anything in there that would say don't vaccinate the child? Well, I bet that nurse will from now on. But do they generally do something like that? Part of the problem is vaccines are such routine procedure. And we just, most of us, people in our community would, but most of us in terms of general public just wouldn't give it a second thought. You know, I hear about similar things in doctor's offices. You know, a child is in for one thing and the doctor says, oh, well, just go ahead and give them a shot while they're here. And or this happens when parents, new mothers or even not new mothers are giving birth, and it's just routine that you do all these different things, including giving the baby a hepatitis B shot these days. That's routine procedure. And so it really is important for those of us who have concerns about vaccines not only to have our position and be clear about our position. And by the way, there's really only 3 places legally you can be with a vaccine. You're either doing the required vaccines, or you're exercising an exemption, or you're doing neither of those first 2. And it's people in that third category that are potentially in a problematic place legally, because they may not be in compliance with the law. And if that's the case, then you potentially are subject, legitimately, at least in terms of legal technicalities, of being accused of medically neglecting your child because they are not in compliance with the law. So that's a problem. But I've often am advising parents not only about what their rights are and make sure you have whatever documentation you need, you know, with regard to birth, you need to give the hospital and everybody who's going to be there at the birth or who might be there at the birth a copy of your letter saying no vaccines and against my religious beliefs or whatever it is. But these days we have to go a step further, Rich, and this story you're talking about really underscores this fact. We can't stop even just at informing all the adults. We have to, of course, this would not apply to a birth situation, but with children in school, we have to educate our kids, and we have to teach our kids. And of course, this is really hard to do. The younger a child is, the less feasible it is. But as early as we can, as best we can, and in the most age-appropriate way, educate our kids. You know, my children know that if somebody takes a shot to them in school, they are absolutely to say, no, I can't do that. You have to call my dad. And when I hear stories like this, it makes me insecure, and I go talk to my kids again. Now, you know that if anybody ever comes to you at school or anyone else that says they want to give you a shot, that you have to say no. And, you know, it puts the children in a potentially very awkward place, and it's really unfortunate. But
that's right.
Point,
and your children are really lucky in that regard, Alan. I mean, because, you know, their father is completely up on this issue. I feel sorry for little children who will be kind of herded into the school nurse's office, and you can imagine the sort of undue influence that they would have on a child in that situation. And with some of these wacky laws, all they really have to do is get the child to say okay, and then they can just, you know, give them whatever vaccines or treatment they wish, and then they're protected by the law. It's really a scary situation.
Well, that is a disturbing one. Let's go on that point. There, and we've talked before on the show that there are laws in California and North Carolina, and I have heard recently and have not had time to follow up on this, but that there's a bill in South Carolina, and have also read but not yet confirmed that there may be laws like this in other states. But what we're talking about is what could be called, in general terms, child consent laws, laws that allow children to consent to medical treatment, and in particular to vaccines. So we've got a little bit of movement here that we cautious but positive announcement here with regard to North Carolina. Now, North Carolina's child consent law, the one that we're talking about, allows children to consent to a pretty broad range of medical treatment that includes the prevention of a sexually transmitted disease or any other reportable disease, which basically means any vaccine on the market, just about, you know, if not literally. The first two words in this statute are the words any minor. So in North Carolina, your two-year-old can say, yes, I would like a vaccine, please, in daycare, if he's offered that. And we've seen in North Carolina and other states already experimentation with the use of schools as flu vaccine distribution centers. And so it doesn't take a particularly creative mind to see the possibilities here. You have schools around the state dispensing flu or other vaccines, and you've got a law that says any minor may consent to a vaccine. And what you have is a setup for just bypassing parents altogether. Now, as you know, Rich, I've written and revised a few times at this point a legal memorandum talking about in detail the problems with North Carolina. The particular wording of the North Carolina law, I found 4 violations of state and federal constitutional provisions and 4 conflicts or violations with 4 state and federal statutory provisions. So I'm not going to take time to go into detail on all of that, but I do want to make a couple of broad points that would apply to the same kind of law in any state, and that's the federal law issues. And the first is that it is, in my opinion, blatantly unconstitutional to grant any kind of generalized medical decision-making to children at all. The Supreme Court has addressed that issue in the past and has said that children, even teenagers, and I'm paraphrasing, I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but children, even teenagers, lack the maturity to make medical decisions for themselves, and parents can and must be the ones making those decisions. Now, part of the rationale for the North Carolina law was that they wanted to enable sexually abused teenagers or children of any age, for that matter, to get medical treatment. Well, most states, I'm sure, and certainly here in North Carolina, doctors have authority to treat children in an emergency without the need for a child consent law. if there's some question about whether the situation constitutes an emergency but it looks like abuse, doctors are required to call Child Protective Services, and the CPS folks can take custody, immediate custody, if they see evidence of abuse, and then they can authorize medical treatment. So you don't have to give the child any authority. There are problems now with lack of funding for Child Protective Services, probably in every state as there is here in North Carolina. There are children who are falling through the cracks, I'm sure, and that's a horrible tragedy that needs to be addressed. But you don't fix that by taking away rights from all parents, because what this law essentially says is that every parent in North Carolina is unfit or incompetent to answer these, to address these issues, because they've taken that decision-making authority away from parents and giving it to kids. And that the Constitution does not allow states, properly anyway, to do that. So, in other words, in effect, all parents are being punished because of problems that affect very, very few parents who are abusive or whatever. Do we need to address those issues? Absolutely. No child should ever go without medical treatment, and I don't mean to suggest one iota that should ever be the case. But let's find ways to address this. Well, anyway, I took this to my state senator. It was a political hot potato for her. She's, you know, sent me away. But my, I'm happy to say that my state representative reluctantly has agreed to see if she can find some language, narrower language, that will address the issues that are needed without infringing upon all parents' constitutional rights. But there's a real fundamental issue here that I want to get to. Children collectively are not legally or medically and developmentally competent to make these kinds of decisions. We do have situations in the law where on a case-by-case basis, children who are older but not yet 18 can go before court and say, I have the maturity and a situation and circumstance where I need to be emancipated, for example. And the judge can decide on a case-by-case basis, does this child have the maturity and the circumstances that require and allow this child to be emancipated so that they then have adult decision-making authority, even though they're not yet 18. And surely there are children who are mature enough before 18 to be granted in a court order that kind of adult decision-making authority, but you can't just sweepingly give it to all kids. There would have to be some kind of adjudication process for it to be constitutional on a case-by-case basis.
That's right. I'm with you, Alan. This is just bad law. You're talking about North Carolina General Statute 90-21-5. I just see this as hitting behind this is Big Pharma's agenda. They just want to take advantage of this overly broad language to do what they want and kind of push their vaccines. The way I see it, and I'm in complete agreement with your memo, the laws on the books really already dealt with the situation. If there really is a need, you know, I really see it as just kind of trying to justify their means, but if there is a need to protect children from sexually transmitted disease, then it could certainly be, you know, put in language much more narrow than this. But you're right, this is horrible law because it basically undermines the whole kind of family. It undermines trust between children and their parents. And, you know, as a parent, you know, there's no doubt in my mind. Now, there might be a few bad parents out there, but generally speaking, the children are going to be much better off and much better protected by their loving parents than they are by the state, who's pretty much seemingly bought out by Big Pharma. So,
well, and what the law says on this, that the 14th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution has a due process clause, and what the courts have said on this is that parents have a due process right to be considered fit unless they are proven to be unfit. So it's the innocent until proven guilty concept here. And the courts have said, the Supreme Court has said, that the idea that you would, and again I'm paraphrasing because I don't have the exact quote in front of me, but the idea that you would take away rights from all parents because of the egregious wrongs of a small minority of parents is repugnant to our constitutional tradition. So again, if there are abused children and abusive adults, let's do anything and everything we can to address those issues, but let's not do it by taking away rights from all parents. Now, the law in California that was that took effect this past January is more specific. It's one subsection of a law that basically allows children to 12 and up to consent to HPV vaccines. So it's a much narrower phrase there. But again, the idea that a child can consent to anything absent some sort of case-by-case assessment is just not something that I think can ever ultimately pass constitutional scrutiny. But boy, the hour slides by quickly every week. Let's move on to a couple of other issues that are going on legislatively.
Okay, why don't you talk about what you've done recently in Vermont in terms of trying to protect their existing philosophical exemptions.
And I want to remind listeners that the things we're talking about in terms of legislative activism are usually, for purposes of this show, things that I've been personally involved in. And the letters or documents that we talk about are posted on the vaccinerights.com website. If you go on to the home page, and then there's a link at the top, something about activism and legislation, you'll find your way to the legislative projects page, and you can see copies of the briefs or letters or other things that we talk about that I've written to help activists in the issues that we talk about on the air here. Vermont's had a philosophical exemption for a while, and a bill was introduced recently to do away with the philosophical exemption. And there are, of course, vaccine activists who are very upset about this. For a time, they were considering modifying the language instead of just getting rid of it altogether to include language that would require a medical doctor to sign off on it. This is like a law that was passed in Washington State just last year and has some serious problems, at least with regard to the religious exemptions, because I believe it would be unconstitutional to require a doctor to sign off on a religious exemption. Religious exemptions are not a medical issue. And the federal courts have said we only need two things with a religious exemption to have First Amendment protection, and that is the belief has to be religious in nature, as the law defines that, and sincerely held. And so you go putting other things in the way of that, like a doctor's lecture or signature, and I think you've got a violation of the Constitution there. So they considered this alternative language in Vermont and then rejected it, and now they're back to the original bill, which is just do away with the philosophical exemption. So I have written a couple of letters as this has played out, again, posted at the vaccinerights.com website, to the state legislature there that an activist, and at the request of an activist in Vermont, that word has it is helping to get people's attention to this. I tell you, I went back and forth with this activist about what to put in a letter to the state legislature, because the answer to the question, what's the problem with vaccines, is voluminous. It's probably information that would fill the same amount of printed books as you get in an encyclopedia set. I mean, it's just enormous. And so the question, and Rich, you and I have had this conversation, you know, what are some key points? I don't even think the question is what are the key points, because there's too many of them, but what are some key points that we can use to open the door? We want to get a crack in the door. And how can we say this concisely? How can we say it effectively and authoritatively? And authoritatively often means providing a credible citation. And how can we say it, you know, in the most effective language? So I've done my best at that with some letters, and hopefully it's going to get a positive response. But I think the key starting point I'll mention, I won't try to go down the whole list, but I think the key starting point is that philosophical exemptions do not, or one could argue, do not address a health issue. Let me put it like this, to the extent that they do address a health issue, but they also, separate from that, also address a fundamental human rights issue. The reality is that vaccines cause permanent injury, disability, and death, and nobody can tell you whether your child is the one who's going to have that kind of an adverse reaction or not. And so there's a profound moral and ethical question here that cannot be answered by science.
Right.
And people, you know, may disagree on that, you know, whether you should still have to do it or not, but just the fact that reasonable people can and do disagree on that point is enough for me to argue that the state should not be mandating vaccines absolutely, so should not remove the philosophical exemption. Every state should have a philosophical exemption. In fact, no state should even be mandating vaccines in the first place. If they really work, people will be asking for them.
Right. Well, I think it's very worthwhile to fight to keep the philosophical exemptions that exist on the books. I've often expressed my frustration to you, Alan, that they try to frame the debate in such a way that, I mean, there are limited medical exemptions, but generally you have to take a religious exemption to get out of the vaccination. And so they try to frame it very narrowly as if, you know, people are religious fanatics, et cetera. They won't allow us to debate them on the science. And I think, you know, the best sort of anti-vaccination information, as we've discussed, that I could come up with, and you've cited it quite nicely here in your letter to the Vermont legislature, is that 90% of the infectious diseases of the 20th century, they decline preceding the vaccinations, and also that diseases for which there were no vaccines declined also, and as we've also discussed, in countries where there were no vaccination policies, the same kind of diseases declined dramatically. So it seems like to me there is really no science that justifies the idea that vaccines have eradicated these diseases. There are other variables that account for this, and to me that's one of our biggest arguments.
Right, because the reason that people who favor vaccines, at least those who do so out of a sincere belief that they're necessary and effective, is this fundamental fear that if you don't vaccinate, you'll get sick. In fact, even worse, that if you don't vaccinate, I'll get sick.
Right.
And these are just, you know, it's a fear-based belief. And fear, as we've talked about before, is a difficult barrier to get past. You don't usually get past a strong fear by hammering somebody with information. And that's a whole other subject we can talk about in the future, but elaborate on in the future. But it's a fundamental misperception, and I think once we begin to crack that one open a little bit, if we can get legislators and the general public's attention to the idea that, wait a minute, there is no evidence that if we don't vaccinate, we're going to have, you know, widespread disease, then we can get some real forward movement on what's really going on here, which is a pharmaceutical agenda for financial and possibly other reasons. But Dr. Blaylock came up with something that I had not seen before, which is just wonderful, right along these same lines. He points out that well over 50% of the population today consists of adults, a lot of us from the so-called, you know, baby boomer generation, who were last vaccinated as kids, and that vaccine effectiveness, we now know, according to the medical studies anyway, lasts anywhere from 2 to 10 years. So well over 50% of our population has had no vaccine protection for decades, 20, 30, 40 years or more, over half the population. And have we had any resurgence of disease in our society over the last 30, 40 years? No. And so
right.
The whole notion that you got to get everybody vaccinated or we're all going to die just does not hold up to scrutiny.
Well, I know we're running short on time, Alan. I wanted to actually talk about that longer, but I want to get one more thing in before we run out of time. I want to congratulate you for having the Pandemic Response Project mentioned yet again in an amicus brief in a case which has been appealed to the Supreme Court, and that is Clower versus the Secretary of Health and Human Services. So congratulations. I think that's quite an honor to be mentioned.
Well, thank you, Rich, and it is. The last time was in an amicus brief that went to an actual Supreme Court case. This one is a case that's being appealed to the Supreme Court, and so we're hoping that the court will hear the case. And I'll tell you, we're just about out of time, but what I will say is that it is a vaccine injury case, and that under the current ruling that we hope to get reversed, if the Supreme Court will take this case, under the current ruling, there's an entire category of people who can be injured by vaccines who cannot even apply to the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program to get compensation, can't even apply. And so it's really an absurd ruling, in my opinion, because of that. But we'll stay tuned, folks. We'll give you more updates on that in the future. Rich, I really appreciate you filling in today for Debbie. It's been great to have you here. You're always well-researched and well-informed and articulate, and it's just really wonderful to have you. Thanks for being with us. Folks, we'll be back next Thursday, as we are here almost every Thursday at 12 noon Eastern time. Hope you'll join us. And until then, we'll see you next time.
Welcome to Homeopathy World Community Blog Talk Radio, creating waves of awareness over the airwaves, via the internet, and by friends telling friends they care. Working in unity to promote homeopathy around the globe. Every Thursday, join us for a personal tour of Vaccinations and Your Rights in the U.S., a show co-hosted by HWC founder and homeopath Debbie Brook and attorney at law Alan Phillips. We invite you to comment and call in to contribute your thoughts and questions. Let's go!